Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. ESG, or Environmental, Social, Governance, promises to help the bottom line and the planet at the same time. Is it too good to be true? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of an episode digging into that very question.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Growing up, the only thing R.J. Young knew about guns was that he was black, so guns were dangerous. But he fell in love with a white woman, and her family loved guns. Young's future father-in-law bought him a Glock, a welcoming gesture, and Young went on to become an NRA-certified shooting instructor. But he also says that being black meant that being a gun owner came with complications. This hour on Point, a young black man's reluctant odyssey into guns. And you can join us. Are you an African-American who owns guns? Did you purchase it recently? Tell us why. And what are the issues that come along not just with gun ownership, but as a minority gun owner that you feel that you have to be sensitive to or think about in America today? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And joining us now from Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, is R.J. Young. He's author of the new memoir, Let It Bang, A Young Black Man's Reluctant Odyssey into Guns. And we have an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org. R.J. Young, welcome to the program.
What's good, Meghna? Hey, NPR nerd. So this is awesome.
Okay. That is not the hello that I expected, but you just made my day, RJ. Thanks so much. Well, you tell a truly interesting and terrific story in your memoir, and I just would love it if you could tell us a little bit about it. First of all, what is the first time that you ever held a gun?
Well, I guess my passionate rebuke of the Oxford comma is going to have to wait. The first time I held a gun, my ex-father-in-law handed it to me. I really didn't have an interest in guns. I knew them from TV, watched a lot of movies, listened to a lot of rap music. But they weren't really a part of my childhood, and they weren't really a part of my adult life either. But this was the first gun that I held because it was presented to me. It was something that Charles was very proud of. And it was also presented to me in such a way that you might present a plaque or a trophy or an heirloom. Like, I'm a huge football fan, right? So if I had a football that was autographed by Bob Stoops, Jason White, Sam Bradford, I would present it in much the same way. And that's how it came off later. But at the moment, it's, to me, it's still a gun.
Yeah.
And I was kind of looking at Lizzie, and I was looking at her mother, Nancy, and I was going, is this regular? Yeah. You know, but in that moment, you really don't ask questions. You take it, you look it over, and you hand it back before it burns your hands.
Right. So Lizzie was your then girlfriend, and as you said, this was the first time that you were meeting her family, and you had barely walked in the door, right?
Well, this is the first time I was meeting her father.
Her father, Charles. Okay.
Right.
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 Oh, no, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say I already had rapport, obviously, with Lizzie and Nancy, because I was at that point also her personal trainer. And that's why I felt very comfortable as you can be, at least, in looking at them and going, what don't I know? What don't I know? You know, and that was that began an education that I didn't know that I was going to partake.
Yeah. Now, was it Lizzie who explained to you that this, you know, when her father sort of bolted down the hall, as you write, and comes back with this revolver, right, and shows it to you, that was actually a gesture of him welcoming you and saying, like, hey, here's an important part of my life. I want to share it with you.
Yes, because this is the kind of thing that you talk about after the fact.
Yeah.
Right? I'm not going to bolt from the room, although that might be, you know, a normal impulse. But you also have to remember, this is a man who I wanted to impress. This is a man who I wanted to get to know. And this is a man whose daughter I was dating. So to not stand there and do my best to just take in the moment would have been wrong. But obviously, I asked her after the fact. And yeah, you know, there are little things that you pick up later as you continue to go to the house and just take a look around. And guns are a large part of life for Charles.
How large a part?
So large that he keeps one for self-defense. He kept one in his house for intruders. He hunted. They are things to be talked about. They are things to be collected. They are things to admire.
Huh. So obviously very important to him, as you said. And so at what point, though, did you decide that this was the way that you were going to form a relationship with the man who was going to become, who eventually became, for a time, your father-in-law?
About the time I realized that sports, in particular football, wasn't going to cut it, because that's where I live and breathe. That is home to me. I love sports and I love Oklahoma football. And this man, to me, was the only person in the state of Oklahoma who could care less. You'd ask him, what do you think about what Bob did? You know, Bob Stoops, who was at the time the head football coach at the University of Oklahoma and perhaps the only other person who could have run for governor and won without ever being on the ticket. And he would say, I think he should be fired. And I would say, why? Well, I think they should all be fired. We don't really need college football or college football coaches. And that's, you know, that's a tough thing to come back from. So in that way, you know, yeah, I could have let it go and I could have just been like, okay, well, I don't really care what you think and I'm going to go on with my life. But that's also not how I'm built. I lean in a lot. And this journey was me leaning in all the way.
Yeah. Okay, so tell us about that then, because there's a really interesting part of the book where how long after that first meeting did you go? You went to a gun show with Charles. How long after that first meeting was that gun show?
Oh, this had to be about 2 years, because I was doing all of this reading and I was exchanging notes on local history and guns with Charles. And the deeper that I got into it, the more conversations would stymie around, well, you know, you don't have one, so you wouldn't necessarily know this. And he would even go so far as to allow me, when we got to this point, to, you know, examine his firearms, unloaded, of course, magazine, elsewhere. We were always very safe, and he was always doing that without me knowing it. And I appreciate that more now than I used to, knowing what I know about guns. But, you know, this is fairly deep into my relationship with Lizzie and approaching the time for which, you know, he would become my father-in-law.
Yeah. And so you hadn't, before the gun show, you hadn't actually fired a weapon with Charles, or had you?
I had not.
You had not.
I had not.
So that was kind of a momentous decision then. You're doing all 2 years, you said, worth of research and conversations with Charles about guns and the history of firearms in America. Why did you reach the point where you were like, okay, you know what? I have to own my own weapon now. What brought you to that point?
I think it's for a lot of the reasons that perhaps myself, being, you know, an NPR nerd, you can only ascertain from reading and from watching, but you will get into conversation, especially when you're approaching political topics or racial topics, about experience. And experience matters a great deal, and we know this. We do not appropriate other people's stories, and we do not speak from a position for which we have not earned. And this was a position that he had earned, knowing and being extremely knowledgeable and having experience with firearm. I did not have it.
Yeah.
I had not felt the weight of that in my hands. I had not felt it fire. I did not know what it meant to walk around with it on my person, or to be in a position to where I might have to use it. And that, I feel, is where a lot of people stop in their education about what gun ownership means.
Mm-hmm. So I really appreciate what you just said, that in order for you to truly connect with him, like, you had to fully enter the world that was most important to him. And that's what takes you to this enormous gun show in Tulsa, right? I think there's something like, what, 40,000 people that go to this gun show over the course of a weekend?
Yeah, we're talking about Wanamakers.
Yeah.
Wanamakers in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Shout out hometown. This is put on twice a year, November and April. And it's not just guns. It's guns and guns related. And it is at the Expo Square. And it is a very, very big deal. It is such a big deal that a parking lot that I had never seen full was not only full, you probably drove around 45 minutes trying to find a parking spot. And then you paid to get into the show.
Yeah.
And so just the knowledge of that, right? The understanding of that and knowing that this is a 2-day event, right? Just everybody's in here. It's packed to the gills. And then to look around and not see a whole lot of people that look like you, Magna. That is an experience that I still have a difficult time giving to folks who walk into rooms where they can see people that look like them. And more often than not, believe what they believe as well. But in this place, I'm a black man. When there were some black folks, but, you know, I don't recall them. I know that they were there. And I know that if I was not walking with Charles, that I would have been unable to just walk that place by myself.
You sure because about of, that?
Yeah, my anxiety, in the way that I walk around in the world, I would have had to walk outside. I would have had to catch my breath because there's a lot of firearms. None of them are loaded. And there's a lot of folks walking around with firearms in their hands. And there are lots of symbols around for which I might take offense. And for some folks, rightfully so.
Symbols such
as? So that
as?
Was always hard.
But what symbols such as what?
Confederate flags and later... an SS Nazi uniform.
Well, we are talking with RJ Young. He's author of the new memoir, Let It Bang, A Young Black Man's Reluctant Odyssey into Guns. And we'll hear a lot more of RJ's story when we come back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken? A podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. A recent episode featured a debate about ESG or environmental social governance.
This sounds like more work than just putting your money into a social impact fund.
It's a lot more work.
Yeah.
Anybody who thinks there's an easy solution here is either engaged in puffery, greenwash, or deceiving themselves.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with RJ Young. He's author of the new memoir titled Let It Bang, A Young Black Man's Reluctant Odyssey into Guns. And we have an excerpt of that book at our website, onpointradio.org. And RJ, just before the break, you were telling us about your first experience at this massive gun show in Tulsa, Oklahoma. But there's so much detail that you write about just this one experience. We could spend the whole hour talking about it. But I want to just kind of fast forward to the key moment here is that Charles, your one-time father-in-law, he ended up actually buying you a gun at the gun show. Isn't that right?
Yeah. And I think what people don't take from that is that where I'm from, Oklahoma, guns are a way of life and not always for the reasons that we might think or the reasons that we might read about. They are integral to the way that fathers get to know their sons.
Yeah.
And in some instances, when you're much younger, that father might buy you a .22 rifle so you can go hunt the wabbits, or, you know, squirrels or what have you. And this was him doing something fatherly for me, which was buying me my first gun.
Hmm. What kind of gun was it?
Glock 26. Call it a baby Glock. Fits in your pocket.
Well, why'd you choose that one?
Because I was interested in self-defense as much as any other part. Marksmanship came later. But at that moment, you know, we're talking about carrying. We're talking about firing a weapon. We're talking about understanding what lethal force is. We're talking about the mechanics of self-defense shooting, of defensive shooting. And we're talking about why some people had begun buying firearms and even as far back as 2011, 2012, and what that meant. Those were many of the conversations that I was having. I was not having conversations about shooting better than Annie Oakley. I was having conversations about staying alive.
Okay, so what was these are conversations you were having with Charles?
Yes.
Yeah, so what was he telling you about why, what was his thoughts about why some people were buying firearms in 2010, 2011?
People want to protect what's theirs. People feel that that is their right, and it is, right? We have laws that say this. And people are very, very interested in letting everyone else know, if you come over here, you might not walk away. And that, for many, is a deterrent.
I mean, I guess one thing I was wondering is, just before and after President Obama was first elected, we saw a surge in gun sales. Did that ever enter the conversations with you and Charles?
Oh, yeah. And also, when I approached this topic with other folks, it was always a question of how much ammunition might cost, right? And this is the state where you can buy ammunition at a sporting goods store. You know, like we have what are called, at the time, Academy Sports. And you can walk in there and buy any real caliber of handgun ammunition. And how much of it people would buy relates to who's president. So, for instance, now there's kind of a surplus and people can't really move firearms as much as they could when President Obama was in office, because a lot of people still harbored a fear that somehow the president was going to round up your guns and try to take them from you or limit the kind of firearm that you might be able to buy. So you should buy this kind of assault rifle or this kind of handgun. And those, while, you know, fictitious, were also real fears. And I've always said this, and I wish people would really take it to heart, because I do. It does not matter if what you believe isn't what someone else believes. It matters that you believe that they believe it. So if someone tells you they're afraid, take them at their word. Don't tell them to their face that they're wrong. You're going to irritate them and make them mad. Now, make their fear your fear and then walk through it. You know, walk that out. And that's where I was trying to take this conversation, even before, you know, I even thought that I might entertain becoming that good with a pistol, and I would get stymied, mostly for the reasons that we've already spoken about.
Yeah. You know, I was wondering if you might be able to read to us the section of the memoir where you talk about the day that you got home, or what you did after you got home with that new Glock that Charles, your father-in-law, had purchased for you. Could you read that part of the memoir to us?
Yes, ma'am. It's got a lot of Oxford commas in it. The day I got back home with my new gun, still in its box, I set it on my bed and looked at it for some time. I hadn't opened it at the gun show. I knew the gun inside the box had never been fired, and I knew it was mine. I didn't feel proud. What I felt was something more like fear. Like the fear I was taught to have for the God of the Old Testament, the being who was so merciful, he drowned the planet, cast out a favorite son, and told a father to murder his son to prove his love. Fear, the way I was taught to feel it as a black man trying to earn an education, navigate among the police, stay out of jail, and stay alive. I knew that the first time I lost respect for that pistol no larger than my fist, it could kill me or get me killed. I opened the box and picked up the Glock. I was amazed at how intuitive it was. The process of removing the empty magazine, putting it back and racking the slide. Was it really that easy? A person with a gun tends to feel a lot like Superman with X-ray vision, laser sight, and Hulk smash strength. Which is why telling that person not to use those superpowers will generally result in the person looking at you like you're the lunatic. I pointed the gun at the blank white bedroom wall in my second-story apartment and squeezed, feeling the hard click of the trigger, the soft tap of the hammer in an empty chamber. I put the gun back in its case, knowing that next week, the chamber would no longer be empty, and that this bit of polymer, plastic, and metal would no longer be an expensive paperweight, but a weapon so lethal, I wish we could uninvent it.
That's R.J. Young reading an excerpt of his new memoir, Let It Bang, A Young Black Man's Reluctant Odyssey into Guns. R.J., you know, I wonder if you could explain to folks who, listening to that excerpt, do you show this deep respect for the power of the weapon in your hands, definitely conflicted feelings about having it at all? So how is it that you got from that to being a certified NRA shooting instructor?
I got to a point in my journey that I wanted to answer one fundamental question that was presented to me over and over and over again as a truism. The truism was, a good guy with a gun is better than a bad guy with a gun. And I put a question mark at the end of that statement and wanted to find out for myself if that was true. And thus began countless rounds and trips to the gun range to get good, really, really good. Like Master Yoda on Dagobah, this is how you use the Force, good.
Yeah. And you did it. Sorta?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I did.
But
eat your heart out, Raylan Givens.
But, you know, I mean, so the thing is that you have, you tell in the memoir and you're describing to us now how, you know, in order to connect with your father-in-law and your just own passion to really throw yourself into understanding this culture that he's so much a part of, that you become, as you said, like you're pursuing a Jedi dream. But I have to underscore, like on the very next page from the excerpt that you just read, you write specifically that you were preparing for an odyssey into white gun culture, not just gun culture in general, but white gun culture as a young black man. So how much, you know, as you were going through this odyssey, did you feel that, you know, the people that you were meeting and encountering and befriending, how much did they see your, you know, you as a black man with a gun?
I don't know that that was ever the thing that was at the forefront of my mind at the time, because of the small group of people for which I was exposed to in this journey, right? But also, I write white gun culture when I could just write gun culture, because I would ask you, Meghna, how do you tell the difference?
Well, how would you answer that question?
Well, no, I mean, that's kind of it, right? And this gets back to race and culture. What is black culture? What is white culture? Well, we can talk about those things that make us uncomfortable, but what it comes down to is what many say that it is. And there are lots of folks that are telling you what gun culture is from their point of view. And many of them are members of the NRA. And we know that that has an effect because of what we're going to get into later, which is the founding of the National African American Gun Association, among other notable minority gun associations.
Yeah. Well, RJ, stand by here for just a second. I just want to note that since you mentioned the NRA, that we did reach out to the NRA itself to see if they wanted to come on or had a comment regarding your memoir, and they declined our invitation. But we also have a lot of callers who actually want to join us. So, RJ, hang on here for just a second. Let me turn to Maurice, who's calling from Dayton, Ohio. Maurice, you're on the air.
Hello. How are you?
I'm doing well. What's your thought today?
Well, you know, a few things. I mean, it's amazing. First of all, RJ, that's an amazing book. I mean, in terms of what your introspective lifestyle, growth, and maturity of guns. I have guns. My father took me hunting when I was about 13, I believe. And it was just a short stint, but it was something that played a very important part in my overall development. Basically being responsible, you know, how to carry a, you know, a 12-gauge bolt action, right, you know, and just being overall amazed on how much power and privilege you have in your hand. But, you know, the stigma of being considered black or black American or African American and carrying a gun or having a gun has always been part of the systemic, I don't know, ideology that somehow, you know, if you give this person of color a gun, you may have problems in the long run, especially during the Black Panther movement. That was before my time, of course, but just going back in history and many other organizations that came about in terms of protecting their communities. And then, you know, you're looking at Chicago and many other issues that spur with gun violence.
Yeah. Maurice, I'm going to take it back from you there because, I mean, you're pointing out of the Black Panther movement. I was reminding myself of a lot of the history that actually RJ covers in his book, and that, for example, then Governor Ronald Reagan signed California's state ban on open carry almost in direct response to the Black Panthers open carrying in California, saying that they defend themselves against racial attacks in the 1960s. But Maurice, thank you so much for your call. RJ, hang on here for another second, because I actually want to introduce one more voice in this conversation while I can. Douglas Jefferson joins us now. He's vice president of the National African American Gun Association. It's a network for African American firearm owners, gun clubs, and outdoor enthusiasts. Douglas Jefferson, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna. Thanks for having me today.
Thanks so much. You know, RJ just mentioned a little bit earlier about the NRA, and then he said, well, we also have the National African American Gun Association. You only relatively the organization was only recently founded in the past couple of years. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct. The organization, National African American Gun Association, was founded in 2015. February of 2015, actually, by our founder and current president, Philip Smith. He founded the organization because he was beginning his journey into firearms, and he recognized that where he was going at the time, there weren't a lot of familiar faces, other people that looked like him at the range, so he wanted to put together an organization that spoke specifically to that, with our mission being to establish a fellowship by educating on the rich legacy of gun ownership by African Americans and offering training that supports safe gun use for self-defense and sportsmanship and advocating for the inalienable right of self-defense for African Americans. And so we took that and we've grown the organization from just you know, a handful of folks in Atlanta. We initially started in 2015 and expanded to nearly 30,000 members nationwide and over 60 chapters across the nation.
So that's rapid growth then over just a couple of years. Why do you think you've attracted so many members?
I think it's a number of things. So one, obviously, there is a and has been for as long as this country has existed, black people that use firearms and that use firearms in a moral and ethical manner and in a legal manner in order to support their human rights that they have in this country that have not always been respected in reality or on paper or in reality. And so that black tradition of arms being there, certainly those folks gravitated to our organization. Additionally, I mean, you have the issues of what's been going on politically in this country. We saw the 2016 election was very polarized, and there was some disturbing rhetoric that was mentioned in the election. And you also saw a number of instances of individuals, particularly white individuals, that were harassing or calling for harassment or harming black people. And so that was really eye-opening for a lot of folks in this country and made them sort of take a second look at, well, what are the rights that I have and how can I use these rights to protect myself and protect my family? One of the third thing I would say that has led to the rapid growth is that as an organization, we really focus on talking about that history, that Black tradition of arms within the country that is not very well known, unfortunately, but we're trying to change that by really educating within our organization and letting people know that, hey, this does exist. You know, you as a Black person owning firearms in this country and using firearms, whether it be for self-protection, whether it be for hunting, whether it be for target shooting, this is nothing new. And so you're actually taking your place in a long line of your ancestors that have already come before you.
Well, Douglas Jefferson, Vice President of the National African American Gun Association, a network for African American firearms owners, gun clubs, and outdoor enthusiasts, thank you so much for joining us today.
No problem. Thank you.
Well, we are speaking this hour with R.J. Young. He's author of the new memoir, Let It Bang, A Young Black Man's Reluctant Odyssey into Guns. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, On Point listeners. I'm poet and author Shinyi Pai. As you celebrate Asian American Pacific Islander Heritage Month, I invite you to listen to the 10,000 Things podcast from KUOW and the NPR Network. 10,000 Things is a podcast about modern artifacts of Asian American life, ordinary objects that tell extraordinary stories and reveal something profound about the experience of being Asian in America. Find 10,000 Things from KUOW and the NPR Network, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're speaking this hour with R.J. Young. He's author of the new memoir, Let It Bang, A Young Black Man's Reluctant Odyssey into Guns. And R.J., just before the break, we heard Douglas Jefferson there, Vice President of the National African American Gun Association. I'm just wondering what you thought of what he had to say, that there's there were a bunch of reasons why the association was formed, protection, the desire for self-protection amongst African-Americans. And he was also talking about trying to get the word out about African-Americans and gun history in America.
Yeah, and I got to profile Doug for the book. So that was cool. I hadn't heard his voice in quite some time. It's been on tape. But that's the message. The message is there is a responsible way to use this. There are folks like myself who believe that they should be armed for self-defense. And there is the historical aspect of guns were taken from people who look like you. And that is not something that you get to dismiss out of hand. And I take that part straight to the heart.
So I'm just wondering, I hear Douglas Jefferson saying that a lot of African-Americans, maybe there's increasing interest in gun ownership because of the concern about self-protection and perhaps especially in recent years. But RJ, did you ever feel like you were actually potentially making yourself less safe by carrying a weapon, especially open carry, because of the fact of implicit bias or racism in America? And I mean, I'm dancing around a question, but I cannot help but to think of what happened to Philando Castile, who was a legal gun owner in America and disclosed to an officer that he had a weapon and was shot dead.
And that incident speaks more to what the NRA should have done and an opportunity for them to stand up for folks like Philando Castile and like Doug Jefferson and the people for which that organization represents. But in regard to me, Yeah, gun ain't gonna help me, man. Magnet, let me break it down. I walked into studio, right, where I'm a member, KOSU, shout out. And I have on a Black Panther shirt. It's got a Quayle on it because that's what the movie's really about. I have on a Black Panther hat, Wakanda, stand up. I wear jumper jeans. I wear Jordans. I have locks that are braided up. If I have a 9mm Glock 17 on my hip, that ain't going to be the kind of thing that makes people at home and at ease. And that has a lot to do with the way that I'm dressed, and it also has a lot to do with my skin color, believe it or not. I know people don't necessarily want to believe that, but I still encounter rooms where I am not welcome. So I don't get to go around as if that doesn't matter, but I also don't get to go around as if a gun in a room is not bigger than any elephant you can walk in there. You're not going to have an open and honest conversation with someone if you know that they have a firearm, because that is the threat of hurting you because they don't like what you have to say. And that's not correct and that's not right, but it is true. It is a fear. So in the course of getting really good with a firearm, I'm also a journalist and I am asking questions and I'm looking at data and I'm looking at statistics and I'm taking account of my own experience. And what I come to find out is not only am I not safer, I'm in more danger if I have a gun on my person, yeah. If I have a gun within reach.
Hey, so I'm thinking about your former father-in-law, Charles, now. Did you ever tell him this, that the very same desire for self-protection that made him such a firearms enthusiast, even if you shared that desire, you actually felt less safe because of the fact of race in America when you had the weapon than before you didn't? Is that something that he understood?
Later. Uh-huh. Later, as we continue to go through this, and later as I had my credentials, as I had a standing from which to had continued this discussion, like we had spoken about, yeah. I hadn't fired a gun, but I also was able to outline this in the book with a use of force attorney here in Oklahoma. And he had a similar discussion with a friend of his. This attorney was white, his friend is black, and his friend, who he was really respectful of and was reverent about, said, "Hey man, when I get pulled over and you get pulled over, it's just different. And I don't need you to tell me that it's not. I don't need you to tell me that people should not judge me by the color of my skin. I need you to recognize that it does happen and to support me. And the way you can support me is to speak up for me in the rooms that I'm not in, that I'm not allowed in, that I might not ever walk into." And I thought that was where I got to with Charles. Uh-huh. And I could see that toward the end.
Yeah. Well, RJ, hang on here for just a second. So many interesting people about this conversation, or about this issue, I should say. I want to bring in one more voice. Tiffany Ware joins us now. She's joining us from Cincinnati, Ohio, and she's founder of the Brown Girls Project, a group that offers makeup workshops and other activities for building self-esteem in African-American women and girls. And she also organizes firearms training classes for African-American women. Tiffany Ware, welcome to On Point.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
So how long have you been a gun owner and then teaching or organizing firearms classes?
Organizing the firearm classes since December 2016, so a couple of years. Owning one for about a year.
Okay. And before that, guns in your family?
Not really. Okay. I have a grandfather from Crawfordville, Georgia, so he was a hunter. You know, he had an old shotgun that he kept in the house because he had five daughters and two granddaughters, and we knew that what that was, but there was no training, no interacting with it.
I see. So what was the reason that took you to buy a gun?
Actually, it was this new, I don't want to say new, but this heightened racial tense climate in the area that I live in that made me say, I need to be able to protect myself and as a single mother, be able to protect my children. During the Trump campaigning, my children were very, very tuned in to what was happening with politics, and they were able to feel the tensions rise as well. And they were very concerned. And when Trump got in office, my son, who was 15 at the time, was very emotional about it, and he was concerned about what was going to happen to us. People were being feeling okay to be more aggressive, to say things that they didn't say before, to invade your personal space. And he'd heard all these stories. What if somebody does something to us? And him being, you know, I have a son and a daughter, and then it's myself, he's like, well, I have to protect you guys. And I'm like, no, wait, kid, that's my job. And then I thought about it, like, how would I really protect us?
I'm sorry, Tiffany, I didn't mean to interrupt there, but do you feel now that having a gun has made you and your family safer?
I feel protected. I feel that if someone crosses my threshold, I have something other than my fist and an iron to throw. I feel that at night when my kids were coming home from extracurricular activities and the seasons changed and it's gotten darker, if someone were to approach us, I definitely feel like I can handle myself and make my kids safe.
Yeah. Hey, RJ, what do you have to say to Tiffany? Because I hear her, and I hear the voice of someone who feels that that the places that we usually look for protection in society, government, law enforcement, et cetera, that our fellow citizens, that there's a failure there, which is why she felt like she needed to buy a firearm to protect her and her kids. That perhaps that sense of society failing us is also a reason why a lot of white gun owners buy a gun. And it just, to me, feels, I understand Tiffany's desire, of course. Every parent wants to protect their child, but it feels like we're all failing each other if we're turning to weapons as the means for protection.
I had this very discussion with my girlfriend here recently, who is in charge of a 5-year-old and a 3-year-old, both girls, and she's a single mom. So yeah, she's going to do everything in her power to protect her children. Now, I don't have children and I'm not married. So I have the privilege of saying, nah, I'm not going to have my firearms loaded. I'm not going to have them anything other than paperweights. But yeah, we have let each other down, and I can look at the system that was set up around me and say that it let me down. Going back to my grandmother, who I write about in the book, and all the way up to this summer, man. I mean, I'm on a book tour talking about my journey into guns and why I think it's dangerous and why I think that it prevents conversation, and Antoine Rose is shot by someone who is sworn to protect him. That's a child. Trayvon Martin's a child. Tamir Rice is a child. Laquan McDonald's a child. They're all children. And I come apart thinking about that.
Yeah.
Because parents protecting their kids, I understand, but that was the charge of all of us. Yeah, I was one of these children who could have been at the wrong end of a gun because a person thought that I was threatening to them, even when I'm walking down the street. So I hear her.
Yeah.
And I hear all the parents. And I don't see how having a gun to protect myself is going to help get to a place to where we can have this conversation about why it is we are so scared of each other.
Tiffany, what do you say?
I say that the system and society has failed not only people of color, but women and children. The system is built to thrive and protect on white male privilege. And so for me, I'm not as much as interested as having the conversation, because who am I having the conversation with? You know, the conversation happens after who's dead.
Yeah.
It's not going to be me. Hmm. So I'm coming from a place of protecting what I love by all means necessary. And that's all I know. The conversations have happened over and over and over again, and every time the system seems to fail those of us who don't look a certain way, who don't live in a certain place, who don't have certain things. So my job as a mother is to protect what I love.
Right. Well, Tiffany Ware, founder of the Brown Girls Project, offers makeup workshops and other activities for African-American women and girls. She also organizes firearms training classes for African-American women. Tiffany, thank you so much for being on the show with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, RJ, we've got, there actually were a lot of callers here, and I'm fast running out of time. So let me just see if I can get at least one or two people in here, if that's okay with you. Let's go to Kevin, who's calling from Louisa, Virginia. Kevin, you're on the air. Kevin, you there?
Hi.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can. Go ahead.
My initial comment was that I was afraid the conversation was being framed wrong because here in rural Virginia, it is totally normal for people of varying colors to have guns because most people are hunters here. And I like RJ's premise. I think it's a good conversation, but I think it's missing some of the population. So I just wanted to bring in that idea that, you know, it's totally normal for black people, white people in rural America to have guns, and that doesn't, like, look, it doesn't look on its face.
Yeah.
To be anything other than normal.
Well, Kevin, thank you for your call. RJ, what do you say?
Say, bro, I'm from Oklahoma. What we have is rural. We have Oklahoma City. We have Tulsa. So I encounter many of the people that you are speaking about, and they feel like you do. I also encounter many of the same people who will not hesitate to protect what is theirs and protect themselves, even as they go about recreational hunting.
And so meaning what?
Meaning, I don't think that this book was written missing that population. It starts out in Coweta, Oklahoma, and I would challenge you to find that on a map if you are thinking that this conversation was framed without rural populations in mind. That is my home. Oklahoma is my home, right? We had to see the world. We got to go through Dallas or Denver, dude. So I understand where you're coming from, but I also very much wrote this book with everyone in mind while couching it in my own personal narrative, which goes from Tulsa to Coweta, which is in Wagner County, and back again. So I don't think that that's correct.
Yeah. So RJ, we've got about a minute left here, and I'm still thinking about the reading that you did for us earlier in the hour about how you felt and what you were thinking the first time you held the Glock that Charles bought for you. You said that you have your guns still, but they're not loaded, and they're pretty much like paperweights in your house. But as you've come through this odyssey, when you look at those weapons now, what is it that you think and feel?
I feel reverence. I feel history. I feel proud of my grandmother. I feel proud to know that I am a product of her and her strength and going all the way back. But I also look at them and I think these are the things that folks went into the houses of people like me to take away. And I don't get to pretend that doesn't matter. So I will keep them because that is my heritage as well.
Well, RJ Young is author of Let It Bang, A Young Black Man's Reluctant Odyssey into Guns. We have an excerpt of the book at onpointradio.org. RJ is a journalist and also getting his PhD at Oklahoma State University as well. So I got to give you a shout out for that, RJ. Thank you so very much for joining us.
Thank you, Meghna. It's been a lot of fun.
You're terrific. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
Can profit motive save the planet? Is a company that takes the climate into account a better investment? How about one that pays workers a living wage and champions transparency and board diversity? That's the idea of ESG, or environmental social governance.
Sounds like a wonderful story. You can make more money, you can save the planet at the same time. Almost no one is going to turn that down.
It's a story that Andy King of Questrom and Veet Henish of the Wharton School challenged during a recent event at Questrom. Professor King played the critic, who says these are problems for regulation to solve, not markets.
As a famous economist said to me, you can't fix externalities with the profit motive, because the profit motive is not linked to externalities. Externalities are the byproduct of pursuing profits. So you can't fix them by getting people to even look harder at profits.
Meanwhile, Veet emphasized that ESG can be an important part of the solution.
Regulation matters, and we need better regulation. And we need to reallocate trillions of dollars of capital over time to the climate transition alone, forgetting social justice, racial justice, and other ESG issues. We're going to need the profit motive for that. No government regulation is going to reallocate tens of trillions of dollars of capital alone. It's going to be investors who are looking at current government regulation and future government regulation and trying to connect the dots.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.